You know, sometimes I wonder if people who glamorize and fantasize crime go to some special kind of hell. And whom am I kidding? I'm not going to heaven. Jeez, no. But then, I think we would have some other special kind of hell for us, Satan planning for it down there. For us true crime community people. But then, yeah, just a thought. I mean, I just always wanted to fall in love, move to Pacific Northwest and find missing persons and hunt down serial killers together. That's my, you know, the kind of life partner I was looking for. With this kind of thing, I think I wouldn't definitely not find that kind of partner, but yeah. It's Halloween month, so I had this weird but awesome idea for an Halloween costume. It's like the theme would be a gradual mutation. It's like, you know, appear to the Halloween party or wherever you are apparently doing your party, wear a lab coat to the party and chat about your experiments on crocodiles, you know, just crash a party and go ahead. Big parties, no one would recognize you. Every hour, go to bathroom and apply more scary makeup. Ask people for meat and act suspicious, just like you're covering something inside your coat and stuff like that. At the end of the night, put a lab coat on a crocodile and let it loose. You're getting it, right? I mean, this would work very much in Florida. Rest of the people, I am not sure. Yeah, not sure about rest of the people. I mean, these days, especially in Halloween time and after I started my true crime podcast and stuff like that, you know, half conversations have gone wild. So my friend went total burlesque on me and she was like, why is helping you hide a body is the standard for true friendship? I mean, apparently she was my best friend, so I wanted to make sure that she's on my side in extreme conditions. She was like, look, if you're in trouble, I'll lie to the cops for you. I'll dispose the evidence, whatever, but please, she said, I can't dig a hole for you. That's very difficult. I mean, I can understand that lady. Whom am I kidding? So just in case you didn't understand what was all that about, I'm trying to make you laugh. No, this is a clue. If you still don't get it, you have to laugh at this point. No, after listening to all this. If you didn't laugh, then just go 15 seconds behind, rewind the podcast and laugh and come back. You know, for my sakes. Today we would be covering The Mad Gasser of Mattoon, which this story takes us to Illinois. Okay, 75 years have passed since several Mattoon residents fell ill during the series of incidents that some at the time blamed on a sinister mad gasser and others later attributed to mass hysteria. The approximately 2 week long series of mad gasser incidents, which started on August 31st, 1944, still sparks the interest of those looking into Mattoon history. Tales of Unknown and Case Studies on Mass Hysteria. The Mad Gasser, if there was one, was never identified or apprehended by authorities. Mattoon Public Library's Local History Center maintains a Mad Gasser file even today, including local newspaper articles written when the community was gripped by fear of clawed figure who was reportedly injecting noxious gases into their homes. The September 8, 1944 Daily Journal Gazette ran a front page article amid World War II news about recent victims of the mad prowler, such as a 60-year-old man who reported being sickened by something sprayed through a bedroom screen window. This case today is known and has long been cited in college psychology classes as a perfect example of mass hysteria occurring during World War II. And World War II has witnessed so many, you know, strange incidences which we cannot comprehend in that this is true, too true to be a reality. Those times when so many men were off fighting and so many women were left alone, the gassings have been explained away as a product of paranoia, panic and delirium. Today, most of the writers analyze these records as an example of mass hysteria in a small Illinois town. It's nothing more than one woman's hysterical report of being gassed and paralyzed at night led to heightened suggestibility of many others. Today, it is pictured as most victims as women of slightly below average social status, supporting that a surge of telephonic calls to the police reporting prowlers and gassers was followed by an abnormal decrease in calls to the police after attacks were judged to be imaginary. So is the case of mad gasser really a case of mass hysteria according to what today's pop culture is portraying, or a giant cover-up to something sinister that has been drawing the nation's attention towards it? In today's true crime episode, we will be discussing about this and discovering the whole lot of truth. In truth can be just a person's perspective, one, and it differs from person to person. It's their own truth, it's their own version of story. You are listening to Crime with Gay. Let's dive into the episode. The mad gasser of Mattoon, also known as the phantom anesthetist or anesthetic prowler, was the supposed perpetrator of a series of alleged gas attacks targeting the residents of Mattoon, Illinois. The incidents began on August 31, 1944 and lasted 2 weeks. In total, about 35 individuals believed they were victims as they suffered symptoms in their own homes. The identity of mad gasser and whether or not the gassings ever really occurred are still a mystery. On Thursday, August 31st, Urban Reef woke to a strange smell in his bedroom that soon became so overpowering that he became physically ill. He woke his wife and she wondered if there might be a problem with the pilot light in the kitchen. She decided to get up and check, but she found that her legs wouldn't move. Thankfully, these symptoms went away in a short time. The pilot light, she found, was working perfectly. The next night, Mrs. Bert Kearney was awakened by a strange, sweet smell in her bedroom. When she tried to move, she found herself temporarily paralyzed. Her screams brought neighbors who called the police, but no sign of a gas leak was ever found. Around midnight, Bert Kearney returned home from work, unaware of what had happened earlier that evening. As he turned into the driveway, he spotted a man lurking near the house, dressed all in black, close-fitting clothing, and a black watch cap. He was standing near a window when Kearney spotted him and turned to run away. Thinking he was a window peeper, Kearney gave chase but lost the man in the darkness. Nearby, on September 1st, three separate households reported similar symptoms. In one family, the mother went to check on her daughter but found that she too was paralyzed from waist down. The mothers and children felt the effects of gaslight in other two homes as well. One of the families had seen Prowler wearing a tight-fitting cap and dark clothing. Although the police drafted incident reports they found no hard evidence to point them in any direction. Early reports also came to the attention of the local newspaper. They had found a terrific story and published sensational articles on September 2nd about the incidents, citing such specifics as to the smell of the gas and explicit symptoms experienced by victims. Their coverage of the story stated that there was some kind of madman out in the dark who was creeping around and pumping poisonous gas into people's home. They called this phantom the anesthetic prowler and subsequently the mad gasser. The poison they claimed could have been chloroform or ether, according to the description of its smell. Over the next few days, more and more people reported to the police and newspaper that they had been the victim of similar attacks. They too had experienced a sickly sweet smell and then burning sensations, nausea and partial paralysis. There were two reports on 5th September, and on that night the police seemed to have caught a lucky break. The first real clue in the mad gasser's case were discovered. They were found at the home of Carl and Beulah Cordis. But what the clues actually revealed still remains a mystery. When Carl and Beulah Cordis of North 21st Street returned home around 10 p.m., after spending a few minutes in the house, they noticed a piece of white cloth, slightly larger than a man's handkerchief, sitting on their porch next to the screen door. Beulah Cordis picked up the cloth and smelled it. As soon as she inhaled, she became violently ill. Her lips and her face began to swell, and her mouth began to bleed. She described the effect as being similar to an electric shock. Her face quickly began to swell. She experienced a burning sensation in her mouth and throat and began to vomit. As with other victims, she also reported feeling weak and experiencing partial paralysis of her legs. Beulah Cordis later hypothesized that the cloth had been left on the porch in order to knock out the family dog, which usually slept there, so that the prowler could gain access to the house, which could go unnoticed. The police were called and they took the cloth into the evidence. In addition to the cloth, a skeleton key, described as looking well used, was reportedly found on sidewalk adjacent to the porch, along with a large and almost empty tube of lipstick. The cloth was analyzed by the authorities, but they found no chemicals on it that could explain Beulah Cordis's reaction. The mystery was just getting deeper by the day. Later, on the same day, the gasser attacked again, this time spraying gas into an open window. The attacks continued and Mattoon residents began reporting fleeting glimpses of the gasser, always describing him as a tall, thin man in dark clothes and wearing a tight black cap. More attacks were reported and the harried police force tried to respond to mysterious crimes that left no clues behind. Eventually, the authorities even summoned two FBI agents from Springfield to look into the case, but their presence did nothing to discourage the strange reports. Panic was widespread and rumors began to circulate that the attacker was an escape from an insane asylum or a German spy who was testing out some sort of poisonous gas. Armed citizens took to the streets, organizing watches and patrols to thwart any further attacks, but several took place anyway. The gas attacks were becoming more frequent and the attacker was leaving behind evidence like footprints and sliced window screens. A local citizens' vigilance group did manage to arrest one suspect as gasser, but after he passed a polygraph test, he was released, local businessmen announced that they would be holding a mass protest rally on Saturday, September 10, to put pressure on already pressured Mattoon police force. Now, the gasser was becoming more than a threat to public safety. He was becoming a political liability and a blot on the public image of the city. The gasser, apparently not dissuaded by armed vigilance and newspaper articles, resumed his attacks. The first few incidents took place at the home of Mrs. Violet Rislisk and her daughter Ramona. They awoke late in the evening to hear someone removing the storm sash on their bedroom window. They hurried out of bed and tried to run outside for help, but the fumes overcame Ramona and she began vomiting. Her mother stated that she saw a man running away from the house. A short time later that night, the gasser sprayed fumes into partially open windows of a room where Mrs. Russell Bailey, Catherine Tozzo, Mrs. Genevieve Haskell, and Mrs. Haskell's young son were sleeping. At another home, Miss Frances Smith, the principal of Columbian Grade School, and her sister Maxine were also overwhelmed with gas and became ill. They began choking as they were awakened and felt partial paralysis in their arms, legs. They also said that as the sweet odor began to fill the room, as a thin blue vapor, they heard a buzzing noise from outside and believed that it was the gases spraying apparatus in operation. By September 10th, mad gasser paranoia had peaked. FBI agents were trying to track down the type of gas being used in the attacks, and police force had to divide its time between looking for the gasser and keeping armed citizens off the street. Neither law enforcement agency was having much luck. By the following Saturday night, several dozens of well-armed farmers from the surrounding area had joined the patrols in Mattoon. In spite of this, 6 attacks took place anyway, including the 3 previously mentioned. Another couple, Mr. and Mrs. Stewart B. Scott, returned to their farm on the edge of Mattoon late in the evening to find the house filled with sweet-smelling gas. This seemed to be the last straw for the Mattoon authorities. While several gas attacks were reported on the night of September 11th, they were all dismissed as false alarms. Newspaper accounts of the affair began to take on more skeptical tone. And despite claims by victims and material evidence left behind, police began to dismiss new reports of attacks and suggested that the local residents were merely imagining things. The gasser could not be caught, and it seemed easier to claim that he never existed at all than to admit that no one could find him. New stories began to appear in the newspapers, where psychology experts opined that the women of Mattoon had dreamed up the gasser as a desperate cry for attention. As many of their husbands were overseas fighting in the war, this theory ignored the fact that many victims and witnesses were men, and that this so-called fantasy was leaving behind evidence of his existence. The Mattoon police chief issued what he felt was a final statement on the gas attacks on September 12th. He stated that large quantities of carbon tetrachloride gas were used at local Atlas Diesel Engine Co. and that this gas must be causing the reported cases of illness and paralysis. It could be carried throughout the town on the wind and could have left the stains that were found on the rag at one of the homes. As for the mad gasser himself, well, he was simply a figment of their imaginations. The whole case, he said, was a mistake from beginning to end. Not surprisingly, a spokesman from Atlas Diesel Engine Plant was quick to deny the allegations that his company had caused the concern in town. maintaining that only use for that gas in the plant was their fire extinguishers, and any similar gases used there caused no ill effects in the air. Besides that, why hadn't this gas ever caused problems in the city before? And how exactly was this gas cutting the window screens on Mathun homes before causing nausea and paralysis? I mean, this is big Among Us game where, you know, we'll be like, you know, I feel the company is sus. I feel this guy is sus, and police are, they are not able to vote, and apparently they escape to the end. We'll see what happens. It's like totally an Among Us game. The official explanation also failed to explain how so many identical descriptions of the gasser had been reported to the police. It also neglected to explain how different witnesses managed to report seeing a man of the gasser's description fleeing the scene of an attack, even when the witness had no idea that an attack had taken place. The last gasser attack took place on September 13th, and while it was the last incident connected to the attacker in Mathun, it was also probably the strangest. It occurred at the home of Mrs. Bertha Bench and her son Orville. They described the attacker as being a woman who was dressed in man's clothing and who sprayed gas into bedroom window. The next morning, the footprints appeared to have been made by a woman's high-heeled shoes were found in dirt below the window. This lady is my spirit animal. I mean, she's wearing high heels to commit a crime. Oh God, I would love to meet her in person. After this night, the mad gasser of Mathun was never seen or heard from again. To this day, the identity of Mad Gasser remains a mystery, as does the reason why he or she chose to wreak havoc in Mathun. Stories have suggested that Mathun's gasser was anything from a mad scientist to an ape man, although who knows where that came from, and researchers today have their own theories, some of which are just as wild. But there are three primary theories about Mad Gasser incident. 1. Mass hysteria and or industrial pollution or an actual physical assailant. The events have also been written about by authors on the paranormal. Could he have been some sort of extraterrestrial visitor using some sort of paralyzing agent to further a hidden agenda? Could he have been some sort of odd inventor who was testing a new apparatus? In 2002, a woman who explained that her father grew up in Mathun during the time when the gas attacks were taking place, he told her that there had been two sisters living in town at the time who had a brother who was allegedly insane. A number of people in town believed that he was the mad gasser, and so his sisters locked him in the basement until they could find a mental institution to put him in. After they locked him away, her father told her the gas attacks stopped. Is this the answer to the mystery? But many claim this was just one side of the story. The other half of the story is that, according to Maruna's recently released book, The Mad Gasser of Mathun, dispelling the hysteria, the real Mad Gasser was not an escaped Nazi, a crazed ape man, or figment of imagination, as many other publications have reported over several decades. Instead, Maruna's theory suggests that Gasser was actually a well-known resident of Mathun, someone from an influential family who had grudge against many area residents and desired revenge against a town that would not accept him. That person, according to Maruna's book, was Fairleigh Livlin, the son of a grocer who was considered a pillar of community. Although his father was highly respected, Fairleigh never fit in to the Mattoon community. When I spoke with people who knew him, says the author, the same words would keep coming up over and over. Odd, different, recluse, loner. Maruna said, although he was highly intelligent and excelled in school, no one really understood him. When Fairleigh returned to Mattoon, after attending the University of Illinois as a chemistry major, Maruna's sources report that he became even more introverted and distant. Spending most of his time in a full-scale cellar chemistry laboratory on his family's property, Fairleigh began drinking heavily. Only days prior to the first mad gasser attack, one neighbor recalls an explosion that resulted from one of Fairleigh's experiments in the secret lab. Was he the Dexter with secret laboratory? And he turned out to be the Dexter serial killer who killed serial killers? We'll check out. Maruna said he has no doubt that the explosion occurred while Fairleigh was testing the gas he would later use to torment local residents. I believe his true motive was to blow up the town, Maruna said. Maruna, a Jacksonville chemistry and physics teacher who grew up in Charleston, said the gas Fairleigh used could have been nitromethane, a sweet-smelling, clear, and highly volatile liquid that can cause nausea, burning of the mouth, swelling of the lips, and minimal eye irritation. Because nitromethane evaporates quickly, little to no evidence would often be left by the time police arrived at the scene of the attacks. Following almost all of the attacks, victims described the gas as smelling sweet, with one person comparing it to the smell of a cheap perfume. It was not long after the gasser attacks began, during the first week of September 1944, that Fairleigh became a suspect. In fact, author said many Mattoon residents told him that they knew Fairleigh was the true man gasser all along. Why then have police and others remained silent for so long? And the author says it was purely out of respect for Fairleigh's family, primarily his father. In fact, it is only because all members of Llewellyn family are now dead that many area residents are finally willing to speak out. In addition, Maruna said a twist in the case cast a shadow of doubt on police suspicions that Fairleigh was mad gasser. Fairleigh was placed under constant police surveillance following first several gassings. However, the attacks continued to occur, baffling police and giving the appearance that Fairleigh was innocent. Maruna believes that in an attempt to clear their brother's name, Fairleigh's two sisters, Florence and Catherine Llewellyn, assumed the role of the mad gasser for final series of attacks. Awesome. Just awesome, right? Sisters, still for everything. It's like sisters who would assist you in the crimes and criminal experiments. This could be feasible as most contemporary descriptions of mad gasser as based on testimony of Mr. and Mrs. Bert Kearney of 1408 Marshall Avenue, the victims of the first Mattoon case to be reported by the media. They described the gasser as being tall, thin man dressed in dark clothing and wearing a tight cap. So apparently this was the first report when his brother, or this is just a theory, when the claimed brother, Fairleigh, would be gassing the residents. So another report made some weeks later, since this was just a 2-week incident, some weeks later in the later part of the second week, described the gasser as being female dressed as a man. The gasser had also been described as carrying flint gun, an agricultural tool for spraying pesticides, which he reportedly used to expel the gas. According to the reports and research, fittingly, the later gassings became much more sloppy and were marked differently from earlier attacks. While Farley had preyed on couples and families during the early gassings, his sisters targeted younger victims, often single women. The final victim of the gasser reported that her sons chased the culprit down a back alley behind her house and later found a set of footprints under the window where the paralyzing gas had been sprayed. Prints that were made by a pair of women's high-heeled shoes, as we discussed before. Although Farley was no longer considered the prime suspect in the case, Lil Wynn's family placed him in a state mental institution following the final mad gasser attack, where he lived out the remainder of his life. Lil Wynn's sisters were never considered as suspects and remained in Mattoon until their deaths. So, is this the final truth? Well, maybe, at least a version of it. Now for some other wild theories or more perceived truths. Could the gasser have been an agent of their own government who came to an obscure Midwestern town to test some military gas that could be used in the war effort? It might be telling that once national attention came to Mattoon, the authorities began a policy of complete denial and attacks suddenly ceased. Is it a coincidence? Whoever or whatever he was, the mad gasser has vanished into the time, and real or imagined is only a memory in the world of unknown. Perhaps he was never here at all. Perhaps he was, as Donald M. Johnson wrote in 1954 issue of Journal of Abnormal and Social Psychology, was he simply a shadowy manifestation of some unimaginable unknown? But was he really? How do we explain the sightings of mad gassers that were made by people who did not even know the creature was alleged to exist? Or identical sightings from independent witnesses who could not have possibly known that others had just spotted the same figure? Was the gasser, as some have suggested, a visitor from a dimension outside of our own, thus explaining his ability to appear and disappear at will? Was he a creature so outside the realm of our imagination that we will never be able to comprehend his motives or understand the reason why he came to Mattoon? Perhaps this is the solution to the mystery, that this is a mystery that we'll never understand. If you think about that long enough, it can make your head hurt. It's a solution that simply causes more questions to be asked. So that's about the stories, that's about the theories, that's about how his or its victims were affected. But it is a sad affair, even today, that these victims or the residents of Mattoon are denied of whatever experience they were going through. Okay, they were real sufferers. People were afraid. They didn't know, did they have to close the windows all the time or did they have to open the windows all the time? It's like, because he was gassing into the people's houses. It was reportedly that through the house and through the windows and stuff like that. You know, people were going through hell given the condition which it was the time of World War II. Their family members were out and this kind of weird incident was taking place. And because it is so worrisome that even today in psychology, this subject is not a subject of real happening. It is not a real-time crime, but it is treated as a case of mass hysteria. The hysteria of heightened senses, illusion of your senses is what it is described as. That is such a sad state of affair for all those victims who may be never existing, but they are survived by their family members. And so I think the worst part, that you know, apart from not getting justice, they were being denied of their experience. They were they were gaslighted of being gassed. Oh my god, I'm so horrible. So you're listening to Crime with K. For more notes, more images on this case, please do follow my Instagram page, that is Crime with K. Do comment on my posts, do like my posts. It would be more informative. It's like, you know, giving out more information on the cases that I would be discussing for the week. So as usual, and always remember to listen to Crime with K, not pop up on my podcast, as the next episode. Take care.